Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dorothy Gundy and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dorothy Gundy.
The Goldman Sachs Group recently eased its rules for what employees wear to work. Then, the company asked them for ideas on what they should wear to work now. Goldman Sachs employees were told to leave comments with the Twitter social media service. The most popular answer was hoodie and sneakers. The second most common answer was a suit. The findings showed that the issue of what to wear to work has become important at one of the oldest, most traditional businesses. Earlier this month, Goldman Sachs sent a letter to its employees. The 150-year-old company said that the time was right to move to a firm-wide, flexible dress code. At the same time, the firm asked its 36,000 employees to think carefully about how they dress for work.
The move toward flexible, less structured workplaces began in the 1990s, said Robert Burke, head of Robert Burke Associates, a service specializing in the fashion industry. The idea became widely accepted with the rise of technology companies like Amazon and Facebook and their leaders. Burke said that Goldman Sachs is one of the last big Wall Street firms to ease its dress code. Facebook chief Mark Zuckerberg is famous for wearing blue jeans and a gray t-shirt. He and his company changed the way people communicate with each other and advertise. When he wore a blue suit to a congressional hearing last year, some people said he appeared smaller or of less importance than his public standing. That event shows that one cannot wear jeans everywhere. But the financial companies knew they must change because they want young people working as their employees. These individuals could just as easily work for a technology company and never have to wear a suit to work.
The clothing rules at Goldman Sachs first changed in 2017 for the company's technology and digital division employees. By including the rest of its workforce, Goldman honors its one firm philosophy and the changing nature of workplaces. The change comes 3 years after J.P. Morgan Chase & Company, the largest bank in the United States, announced its own flexible dress code. The change can be seen among the leaders of financial service companies. Goldman Sachs's chief, David Solomon, sometimes goes to official events without a necktie, as have the chiefs of J.P. Morgan Chase and Citigroup. Talk of the move to business casual is often about what men wear. That is because the banking industry has mostly male leaders. Catalyst is an organization that supports women in the workplace. The group says its research shows that men held nearly 80% of top positions in U.S. investment banking and securities dealing in 2015. For many years, women have much harder choices to make about what to wear to work. Jennifer Hyman is chief of Rent the Runway, a clothing service for women. She told Goldman Sachs in a tweet that none of the answers listed in its survey are related to women and what they should wear to work.
There are fashion tech companies that offer advice for women tired of investing so much time in deciding what to wear. Such businesses want to help women create their own office uniform. Ariel Schur is head of the employment service ABS Staffing Solutions. Schur told the Associated Press that she gets more questions from men nowadays about what to wear for job interviews and meetings. Those kinds of questions have been asked by women for a long time. Guys have always just been able to wear the same suit, change their ties and shirt, Schur said. You have to be more cognitive as a woman, she added. So what is acceptable to wear at the office these days? This is pretty much what we wear, said Ed Silhan, who works for an advertising technology firm. Flip-flops or playground sneakers, I'd stay away from that, he said. You know, beat-up Nikes that you play basketball with. Just look presentable. Silhan wore black jeans and boots as he spoke to an AP reporter in New York's Midtown Manhattan. The Midtown uniform, slacks, button-downed shirt, and fleece vest, has become a common choice for men who work in U.S. offices. That's probably a lazy solution, said Chris Basola of the Need Supply Company. He says it would be better if men created a set of clothing that works for their industry. I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
One morning in January, Kafayat Ullah walked to his school in southern Bangladesh, just as he had done most days over the past 6 years. Kafayat had always been one of the top students in his class. But on this day, the 16-year-old was told he had been expelled. The school's headmaster told him that he and more than 60 of his classmates were no longer permitted to attend school. The reason? A government investigation had identified them as Rohingya refugees. We went back home crying, Kafayat said.
Rohingya are mostly stateless Muslims from neighboring Myanmar, also known as Burma. More than 730,000 Rohingya fled across the border after Myanmar's military launched an offensive against suspected rebels in late 2017. The United Nations has said the violence was carried out with genocidal intent. Thousands of children, like Kafayat, were born in Bangladesh after their parents fled earlier waves of violence in Myanmar. For years, schools in Bangladesh quietly welcomed Rohingya, who live along the southern coast in the world's largest refugee settlement. But the growing number of arrivals has tested Bangladesh's government. Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina has said the country is not able to fully welcome all of the refugees. Myanmar has said it is ready to welcome back the refugees. However, the country from which they fled still is dealing with ethnic tensions and violence. The United Nations says conditions are not right for them to return.
In some countries, governments permit refugees to study in local schools or permit groups operating in refugee camps to teach the national curriculum. But Bangladesh has not recognized the majority of the Rohingya as refugees, and it does not give Bangladeshi birth certificates to children born in the camps. The government has also prevented centers in the camps from teaching Bangladesh's education curriculum, says the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF. The recent school expulsions mean that hundreds of thousands of Rohingya may miss out on critical years of education. Many students are depressed and frustrated, said one 21-year-old. He asked not to be named because he was continuing to pass as Bangladeshi so he could go to university. The young man added, "Yes, we are somehow pretending to be Bangladeshi students. Yes, we have got some education. But now, where will we go? The world should think about this. If we can't study, our future will be damaged. We are hungry for education."
Jamal Adin is headmaster of Leda High School, where Kafayat was once a student. He said of the decision to expel Rohingya, "We are very sorry and disappointed." He added, "The government is providing everything for the Rohingya. Why not education?" But other people support the decision. They include the school's founder, Kamal Adin Ahmed. He said the arrival of the Rohingya has created big problems for the local community. Some have blamed Rohingya for bringing drugs and crimes to Bangladesh. "How do you think I feel? We don't mind the Rohingya, but we mind our lives," Kamal said. In January, the head of Bangladesh's Refugee Relief and Repatriation Commission wrote to school headmasters in and around the city of Cox's Bazar. In the letter, Commission Chief Abul Kalam noted, "It has been seen the trend of Rohingya children's participation in getting education has been increasing." He also noted that some Rohingya were using false identity documents so they could go to school. Abul said, "It is advised to monitor strictly so that no Rohingya children can take education outside the camps or elsewhere in Bangladesh." He told the Reuters news agency that Rohingya were getting an education from learning centers operating within the camps.
But many children and their parents describe the learning centers that international agencies operate as offering mostly unstructured learning and playtime. A temporary school run by Rohingya volunteer teachers opened in February. However, the lead teacher said they had no official permission to operate. Karen Wrighty is a communications officer at UNICEF, which leads education programming in the camps. She said her group was working on making other countries' curriculums into a learning framework for refugee children. "There's a risk in the camps that we will see a lost generation of children if we don't manage to catch them with education," with skills and training at this critical point in their lives, she said. At the Nayapara camp, Kefayat and other expelled students tell stories from their years of secret study in Bangladeshi schools. Some of their classmates were cruel to them, said Kefayat. They used the word Rohingya, Burma, to tease us, he said. Nevertheless, we were happy. We need education. Kefayat dreamed of completing his education and becoming a reporter to help our community, he said. Now, he watches his one-time Bangladeshi classmates travel to and from class in their clean white clothes.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The 1880s were years of important change in American business and industry. 20 years after the Civil War, the United States had become one of the leading industrial nations of the world. As the number of factories increased, so did competition between businesses. Some industrialists cooperated with their competitors to reduce competition. But this did not always succeed. There was no legal way to enforce their agreements. Leo Scully and Jack Weitzel tell how these issues were handled during the administration of President Benjamin Harrison.
In 1879, a new form of business organization was developed, the trust. In a trust, stock owners of many competing companies give control of their stock to a committee or group of trustees. The trustees operate all the companies as one and pay profits to the stockholders. The profits would be high because there would be no competition to drive down prices. One of the first trusts was formed by John D. Rockefeller in the oil industry. The stockholders of 77 oil companies gave control of their stock to 9 trustees of Rockefeller's Standard Oil Company. The 9 men controlled 90% of the nation's oil production.
The success of the Standard Oil Company led to the creation of trusts in other industries. Soon, there was a sugar trust, a salt trust, a steel trust, even a whiskey trust. These huge corporations represented hundreds of millions of dollars. This great wealth made them very powerful. Former President Cleveland, himself a friend of business, warned of a growing danger. Corporations, he said, should be carefully controlled creatures of the law and servants of the people. Instead, they are fast becoming the people's masters.
The public began to demand government controls of the trusts. Farmers claimed that prices were too high, and they blamed the trusts. Workers said their unions could not negotiate with the new industrial giants. Small businessmen charged that trusts were too powerful. They said the trusts could destroy them. Public demands for action led the governments of 15 states to pass antitrust laws. But the state laws could do nothing. Most of the trusts were nationwide corporations, which did business in many states. Public protest was so great that both parties in the 1888 elections promised to pass a federal law against trusts.
A number of such bills were proposed. One, offered by Senator John Sherman, a Republican, was approved by Congress. President Benjamin Harrison signed it into law in 1890. The Sherman antitrust law sounded severe. It said it was illegal for a trust or any other organization to interfere with interstate commerce, trade among the states. It was also illegal for any person or organization to form a monopoly, to get control of a whole industry. The law ordered harsh punishment for any person found guilty of these crimes. It sounded like a strong law, but it was not. It was written in a very general way that left the courts to decide what the law really said. Opponents of the Sherman antitrust bill said its purpose was not to destroy trusts, but to make the public believe that trusts would be destroyed.
During President Harrison's administration, only 8 corporations were accused of violating the new antitrust law. Of the 8, only 1 was found guilty, and only in a very limited way. The first company charged was the Whiskey Trust. A court dismissed the case. It said the government failed to prove that the trust had interfered with interstate commerce. A few years later, the government asked the courts to break up the huge Sugar Trust, which controlled 98% of the sugar-producing industry. The Supreme Court refused to do so. It said that it was true the trust had formed a monopoly in the sugar-producing industry, but it said the monopoly was in manufacturing, not in trade or interstate commerce. Therefore, said the High Court, the Sugar Trust was legal and did not violate the antitrust law.
Industrial trusts helped to reduce competition among American companies. High tariffs also gave some protection from competition with foreign companies. But business leaders were not satisfied. They demanded even higher taxes on imports to further reduce competition. So Republican Congressman William McKinley of Ohio proposed a new tariff bill, one that would raise import taxes higher than ever before. The tax already was about 38% on most imported products. The new measure would raise it to almost 50%.
Not everyone in the Harrison administration supported the high tariff measure. Secretary of State Blaine wanted to increase trade between the United States and other countries. He warned that new high tariffs would destroy those plans. Blaine also opposed the bill because he felt it would hurt the Republican Party politically. In a letter to Congressman McKinley, Blaine said the bill would anger the farmers by adding as much as 8% to the price of shoes for their children. Such movements as this for protection, said Blaine, will move the Republican Party only into speedy defeat.
Most Western and Southern congressmen opposed the tariff bill because it would mean higher prices to the people of their states. But the bill could not pass without the support of some of them. So supporters of the tariff bill offered a deal. If Westerners voted for the tariff measure, then Eastern lawmakers would support a silver purchase bill that the Westerners wanted. The bill, known as the Sherman Silver Purchase Act, would have the government buy 4.5 million ounces of silver each month. The government would pay for the silver with paper money, treasury notes, which could be exchanged for gold or silver money.
Western mines were producing huge amounts of silver. By selling it to the government, the mining interests hoped to keep the price of silver from falling. Western interests spoke in Congress now with a much stronger voice. In 1889 and 1890, six Western territories became states. This added 12 more Western representatives in the Senate and others in the House. The deal was agreed to. Both the McKinley Tariff Bill and the Sherman Silver Purchase Bill were approved by Congress and signed by President Harrison. As expected, the price of imported goods rose, and the people blamed the Republicans.
In the congressional elections of 1890, the Republican Party suffered heavy losses. The Republican majority in the Senate was cut to 8, and not all the Republican senators would support the party on every issue. The Republicans lost control in the House of Representatives. Only 88 were elected to House seats. Democrats elected 235 representatives. Voters also elected 9 House members and 2 senators from a new political organization, the People's Party. The new party was born in farming areas of the West and South. It was a party of protest, formed by men who refused to support either of the two old parties.
Years before, farmers had united in agricultural organizations they called granges. A national grange had been formed. During hard times, the grange organized political action groups to help elect officials who were friendly to farmers. But as farm conditions improved, the granges began to disappear. A few years later, farmers began to build new organizations. Like the granges, they began as social and economic groups. By the late 1880s, many of these groups had united into 2 large organizations. One, with more than 1 million members, was the Southern Alliance. The other, with fewer members, was the National Farmers Alliance. Members of the 2 groups began to unite for political action.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.